Thank you very much. Welcome to High Notes. We are coming to you from the PEPCA Auditorium of the Aspen Institute, and we are being broadcast on Aspen Public Radio. This is a production of the Aspen Music Festival and School. I'm Alan Fletcher, president of the Music Festival and School, and I have am going to have with me today two brilliant performers who are headlining our shows this week. One of those, Enon Barnaton, is in the middle of a masterclass where it appears he's had way too much great advice to give to the young performers, and that is running a little bit late. So he will join us shortly, but I'm delighted to be with Golda Schultz. Golda was a student in our Aspen Opera Center not so many years ago, has gone on to a brilliant international career. I have a few notes here, but I thought I would mention she was born in South Africa, began studying music there, although I think you were a journalism major first.
Yep, that's right.
but found her way to music, and the discovery of a tremendous voice that she had, came to the Juilliard School. During her time at Juilliard, she came to us in Aspen, and then was more or less discovered by the Bayerische Staatsoper, the Bavarian state opera, and made her debut there as the Countess in Marriage of Figaro. But I believe it's true that you sang the Countess in Ghosts of Versailles here, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, I did. I sang that. That was my first role here in Aspen.
Yeah, that was a fantastic production, and thank you for being part of it. She has gone on to make her Metropolitan Opera debut as Pamina in The Magic Flute, and then her La Scala debut as Susanna in Marriage of Figaro. So these are three great Mozart heroines. And indeed, her Salzburg debut as Vitellia in Clemenza di Tito. So that's all Mozart debuts.
Except Donna Anna. I haven't done her yet.
So you have not done Donna Anna.
Nobody's offered me Donna Anna. If anyone's listening, I'm available. I'm okay. Willing and able.
Yes, because you've done Fiordiligi as well.
I have done Fiordiligi. Yeah. She's one of my favorites. Contessa is also one of my favorites. I think all of Mozart's female heroines, I just think, are fabulously written, but especially the Da Ponte females. Mm-hmm. There's just something really, really special about them.
Yeah, beautiful. And actually, this week, Golda will be singing a Mozart concert aria, and we're going to talk about that maybe when Enon comes, because it's a unique piece that has soprano, solo piano, and orchestra. In fact, I think there are no other Mozart concert arias.
No, there aren't any, and it's, what's really special about it is that he wrote it for his first Susanna, and in his catalog, he's notated it as for Mademoiselle Nancy Storace and me.
Uh-huh.
So that's quite special.
Yes, he played the solo in the first performance, we believe. But anyway, we'll come to that when Enon gets here. But I thought we would talk about the other thing you were singing on our Friday concert. This is Aspen Chamber Symphony, 6 p.m. on Friday in the tent. And that is Cantaloube's Songs of the Auvergne. So first of all, where is the Auvergne?
I believe it's in the middle of France. It's this very hilly area, and yes, they speak French, but it's not quite French. Yes, that is how it has been explained to me by French speakers. They're like, it's French, but no.
But no. Okay, and how about Cantaloube? Because this is a composer, I think anyone who hears the songs will go, oh yeah, those, I love those. But you might not know that that is the title and that is the composer.
Yeah, so Cantaloube was, I think we can say early 20th century, mm-hmm. especially these songs, the series from the Auvergne, they were written between the time of 1923 to 1927, 1930. So he spent a lot of time researching and collecting music. So there was a big move at the beginning of the 20th century, especially in Eastern Europe, and parts of England, and also what Cantaloube did, there was a search for folk music and to document folk music, because as we know, most folk music is not necessarily transcribed. It's basically passed on by word of mouth. What you hear, the tune is remembered, the words might change, but technically, it's just word of mouth, and that's how the tradition remains. So there was a big move among some of the 20th century composers like Bartok and Janáček Smetana to collect and collate all this information of folk music and to use that in their search for something new to write. And Kantele was one of these people. So he was big about research, and he was fascinated by this dialect in the Auvergne that no one really understood, but that was just these songs that were so simple and so lovely, and he wanted to document them because he fell in love with the area and he fell in love with the people and their lifestyle. And so this is just what's really special about this music is that it really just is a documentation of adoration for something so special.
Yeah, and indeed last week in High Notes we were talking about the collection of folk song in the early 20th century. So you have Kodály and Bartók, who mostly were writing what I would call modernist music, but with a tremendous folk song base. Then you have Ralph Vaughan Williams and Cantaloup, who are collecting it and placing the folk song into a very romantic and beautiful setting. So I don't know if you've ever done any of the Ralph Vaughan Williams.
I have never done any of the Ralph Vaughan Williams, but I find everything that has to do with folk music and just trying to maintain it and give it new spin, I find that really fascinating. And that's what really drew me to these songs. They're just, you hear the not necessarily the patriotism, but the actual respect for the simplicity of the music and not trying to make it anything more than it is, but really trying to really show the romance of the language and of the songs themselves.
And from a diction point of view, do you sing them in Parisian French, or do you try to do anything different?
I am doing my very best to sing it in the dialect as required. Okay. So the most predominant thing that most people will recognize about the dialect is that there are no nasals, because it's a hilly area, so historically, the first song that he ever transcribed is the first song that I'll be singing on the concert, but it's the second song of the first series, Bailero. The story is that he was sitting behind a rock, looking out over the mountains, and he heard a woman start to sing a call, and then he loved the tune, so he wrote it down as she was singing it, but then he heard someone on the other side reply back, and that was the shepherd she was talking to, and they were communicating to each other, and he started transcribing this all down. Next part of the story, he totally freaked the poor woman out when he came out from behind the rock and started saying, I'm sorry, could you just tell me what it is you were saying? But the story goes is that he impressed her so much because he could actually speak the dialect, not perfectly, but she knew that he was really interested. So she sat with him and she explained what she was saying and she taught him the tune, and that's how Bailero came to be. So that's the first song that he ever wrote down from the Auvergne, and that's why it's so magical. Huh. It really is something special. So a lot of the songs have to do with the tradition of call and response. There's a lot of she speaks, he replies, or he calls out, she replies. And it is a lot about life in the mountains. And so that is how his little love affair with the whole series began. Huh.
Now, a lovely detail, I think, from your biography is that as a very young person encountering music, and I think you had a great love of classical music in your family, but in terms of your own connection, you had an album by Kyrie Te Kanawa, and Kyrie, who also has the full lyric voice that Golda has, the songs of the Auvergne are also a signature for her, and one of the great, great recordings is her recording.
It's absolutely gorgeous. And what's really special about what she does is she really does transport you with her voice. And it's really something fascinating to hear all the colors that she's able to bring out. And listening to her voice gliding along with the orchestration, it's really something tremendous. But my first recording that I ever heard of hers was the Contessa in Marriage of Figaro.
Yeah, because yeah, she also sang all the Mozart roles.
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard her Fiordiligi, which was quite spectacular. That was when Kathy Battle was the Despina, so. Now we are joined by Enon Barnatan, and as our Friday Aspen Chamber Symphony program begins with the Cantilupe that we've just been talking about, it continues with Beethoven's Third Piano Concerto with Enon as the soloist. So I could have 17 note cards with Enon's accomplishments on them. I will mention the Avery Fisher Career Grant and the Martin Siegel Award, which is given by Lincoln Center for an outstanding young artist. Enon's recent appointment as music director of the La Jolla Music Society Summerfest, a position previously held by our own Jimmy Lin. Enon is completing his third year as artist in association, a new title, right? You were the first ever.
Yeah.
Artist in association with the New York Philharmonic, which has entailed many wonderful projects. Recent debuts, I just selected a few, the Leipzig Gewandhaus, Hong Kong Philharmonic, Chicago Symphony, Baltimore Symphony, Seattle Symphony, London Symphony, Helsinki. Enon opened Los Angeles Philharmonic's last season, I'm delighted to say, with my own piano concerto. Also gave a very notable recital at Carnegie Hall this season with Renee Fleming, and also continues with his regular recital partner who will be with us this week, Alyssa Wallerstein. Also, in addition to my own work, Enon has been a champion for many composers. Again, I just made a tiny selection, Thomas Addis, Avner Dorman, I can't read my own writing, Matthias Pinscher, Andrew Norman, one that I really wanted to say and I can't read. Oh, Sebastian Currier. Yes. Yes. Excellent. So, here is Enon. He's been a favorite visiting artist with us now for many years. I thought we would start with Beethoven. And you have done the full Beethoven concerto cycle. You have recorded it, I think. So, how do you see the third concerto within the five or the six, if you count the trio?
Well, the third piano concerto is really, to my mind, the first romantic piano concerto in the literature. The C minor Mozart and the D minor Mozart are actually kind of precursors to that. I mean, they have a lot of that kind of Sturm und Drang, you know, the stormy and emotional. But the C minor Beethoven concerto is really a pivotal point in the development of what we know of as a piano concerto. It's such and it's also probably the most Beethovenian, if you could say that, of the piano concertos. I mean, C minor, of course, is one of his favorite and most recognizable keys. We think of the Fifth Symphony, etc. But that concerto is so, you know, we're so used to it now, but it's so revolutionary in so many ways. And to me, it's also one of my absolutely favorite piano concertos to play in the whole literature. So I absolutely love it. And the second movement to me is the aria or duet that he never wrote. He really sings in a kind of bel canto way. In the way that he doesn't do in his own opera, I think. It could be Bellini.
Yeah.
And it's kind of remarkable how but the most glorious thing is this extended opening in the second movement that is one of the most magical moments in Beethoven.
Well, Beethoven actually had taken lessons in writing Italian melody with none other than Salieri before he wrote some of these great melodies, as in the C minor sonata, too.
Yeah, right.
So, interesting that Mozart D minor concerto that you mentioned was, I think, the first piece to be called romantic by contemporaries. And they were hearing the Byronic romanticism in literature, which had already happened. They were hearing it in Mozart. But I certainly agree with you that the first two Beethoven concertos are much more classical. and then this.
It's a big shift. It's a huge shift between, and then there's another shift that comes between the third and the fourth concerto. I mean, the concertos are not as, they're public pieces. They're not as envelope pushing or not as far looking as the piano sonatas or the string quartets for sure, or even the symphonies, but they are much more traditional pieces, quote unquote. But the innovation there, I think, is within that framework, and it's still very striking. I mean.
And what about the pianism? Because Beethoven made his name when he came to Vienna as a pianist and wrote a lot of his music for himself in order to display that talent. And certainly the first piano concerto was the big success that introduced him to the Viennese public. But he was still playing for himself at the time of the third concerto.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much a vehicle. I mean, it's such a virtuosic piece in so many ways, even though, I mean, I think when we think about the third piano concerto, we think about the opening where the way that the piano comes in, and we think about it as this very dramatic piece, but so much of it is actually in piano and so much of it is lyrical. It is a very, it presents challenges that are also a little different than the way that that he wrote before in the concerto. And certainly in the last movement is incredibly virtuosic it is very much you can hear that he was reveling also in his own abilities as a pianist and showing off.
Which is a good thing.
Yeah.
Now, don't be alarmed, but we're going to take a little detour into some music theory, and Enon was not expecting this, but I'm going to totally put him on the spot. So he mentioned C minor was clearly a very important and very personal key to Beethoven, of course, culminating in the great Fifth Symphony, which is in C minor, but there are many chamber works and the piano sonata, and et cetera, that already existed in C minor. And so he considered it a key of tremendous, profound meaning, I would say. However, when you're writing a multi-movement work in C minor, the normal thing would be to make the second movement, or the slow movement, in E flat major, which is the so-called relative major to C minor. It's a highly related key, but major. And instead, Beethoven writes the slow movement of this, the third concerto, in E major, which is extremely remote from C minor. So why do you think that is?
Oh yeah, it's one of my favorite moments in the piece, actually, is between the end of the first movement and then starting the second movement, because the shock of hearing C minor and E major next to each other is transformative. That chord is almost otherworldly. I mean, because, and I think that is very much meant. If there's one note that doesn't exist in the C minor scale, is E major. E, you know. It's an E flat, not an E natural. So, and suddenly it's a movement based on the thing that was missing in the first movement. So I do think that there is a transformative quality to it that he meant about in that key, and that it's very much, he did that before, kind of unexpected keys, but I think it was also very much a conscious departure from the normal relationship, key relationships.
Also, a physical or acoustic reason for that difference is the scale of C minor and the scale of E major have almost no notes in common. And the notes they have in common are the so-called leading tones, in effect. So they have this extremely distant relationship, but the E major chord sounds so fresh and
yeah, it's hard to do without actually play. I wish I had a piano to kind of put the two chords next to each other. Yeah. But it is. I always wish that in some ways, even though it will never happen, that there's a complete silence between the end of the first movement and the beginning of the It's interesting enough, the Rachmaninoff in the second piano concerto had the same relationship. It had C minor going into E major, second movement going back to C minor. But he actually uses, the beginning of each of the movements is a bridge from one key to another. He actually modulates, which is also interesting to see how you modulate within a few bars from C minor to E major, so it's so remote. But something about that, you know, shift.
Yeah.
Is just wonderful.
Well, another thing about the E major, and then we will stop geeking out on theory, is that the normal C minor first movement goes from C minor to G and back, which is normal. So you have C and G, and then you put E natural in the middle, and the overall key scheme is spelling out C major. And just as he does in the Fifth Symphony, in the Third Piano Concerto, he's going to go to C major for the finale.
Yeah.
So he's prefiguring that in his overall key scheme.
Yeah, no, it is an ingenious, and again, it's hard that we're so used to it now. But I remember just when I went to school, music school, our theory teacher actually used this example. He just played a C minor chord and then an E major chord and then play the C minor chord and an E major chord and just to get us used to how shocking that is. And I think I do that a lot when I teach or a masterclass or something, I'd say, okay, what would be the normal thing to do and what did he actually do?
Yeah.
And then you start hearing, you know, you erase our 21st century ear and go back to how shocking that really is. Mm. And that's a real delight, actually, to do as a listener, as a performer.
Mm. Wonderful. Well, so that's the second thing on the program, Beethoven C minor concerto, then intermission. Now, inconveniently for both soloists, typically you get to do your solo on the first half of the concert, right? Greet the audience, you know, revel in all the congratulations, and then you're done. But both Golda and Enon have to appear on both parts of the program, the Cantaloupe first, Beethoven C minor concerto, intermission, and then they come back together for a very unusual piece, Mozart's concert aria, Chiomi Scordi di Te. And we're going to talk about this a little bit now. Mozart wrote this piece, as Golda has already said, for Nancy Storace, who was a soprano who had been very important in his life. She had been the first Susanna in Figaro, and Mozart had a very closeness to sopranos because he married one. But Nancy was making her farewell performance in Vienna, and he wanted something very special for her. However, he had started this project as a so-called substitution aria in the opera Idomeneo. This is something he actually did quite a lot. Even in Figaro, there are substitution arias that you can choose to take out this piece and put in this other one. We didn't prepare this, but could you explain why he would do that?
Well, it's a very simple thing. Depending on the casting you get, sometimes the soprano, the baritone, the bass, they're not as good as the last one you had. So he was a man of the theater, and he realized that you can't always force people to do something they're not good at. It's not going to make your show any better. So he was very kind, and he was willing to rewrite something. So something like Don Giovanni is also, there's the Mitra di, it's also, he wrote it in one key. I think it was in E flat major. And then another soprano just said, I can't sing it, you need to change it. And so he went, right, opening night, here we go, writing it out real quick. Yeah. So he was a trickster that way. He was very, very, it was very easy for him to do that, so he did it quite regularly. I think the last person I know of in like 20th century who's ever taken an aria out and changed it in nozze is Cecilia Bartoli. She took out the second aria from Susanna, because she was singing Susanna at the Met, and she took out the Act Two aria, the clothing aria, and she turned it in, she used a different one. And I think she also might have, I could be completely wrong, but I also know that the final aria, Susanna's final aria before the big Act Four finale happens, sometimes you can, some people have changed that aria and sung a different one. So it all really just depends. Some sopranos want to do more than was written previously. So he would give them something more virtuosic. Or someone says, I'm unable to do it this way. Can you write something else? And he did it gladly. I think he enjoyed trying, testing his skills.
Well, and I think what you said first is so true, that he was truly a theatrical person, and whatever would make that performance better, he would do. There was no sense of, this is what I wrote, so you had better do it. It was, okay, you don't like that, then
do something else.
Which is very different from Beethoven, by the way, who famously said to a violinist who complained of how hard the part was, he said, do you think I think about your meager violin when I write my music?
Yes. Yes, not so nice. Although, by the way, at the first performance of the C minor piano concerto, Beethoven was the soloist, and his assistant reported that he was playing almost entirely from blank pages. He had not bothered to write it out. And the assistant said there were sort of hieroglyphs every once in a while on the page.
Something.
Yes, but he managed. Okay, so this aria, it starts as an alternative insertion that you can do in Idomeneo, but then when he had the opportunity to present Nancy Storace in her farewell, he thought, I know, she'll sing it, but I'll write a piano part for myself to pay tribute to her as well. And so what results is something that you could not drop into an opera, unless you had Enon hanging around backstage.
Which I usually am.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I can totally see him doing that.
Yeah. But it makes a very wonderful concert piece. So just to open up in a very broad way, is there anything you would like to say about the role of the soprano and how the piano comes in?
Well, I think, for me, there are two points. One is that is a personal point, is that this is the only, the only recording that I have of my piano teacher, her name was Maria Curcio. She was this kind of sainted teacher who unfortunately had tuberculosis during the war and could never have a career as a concert pianist. But there's one surviving recording of her that I have, and it's this aria with Schwarzkopf singing. Oh. And it's just wonderful. So for me, this being the first time I play this is actually very special. Oh. And with just such a spectacular singer. It was just wonderful. Mozart is one of those things that is very, as we always say, it's very difficult in its simplicity. I mean, there's nothing to hide behind. It's just the naturalness of the expression and the sound, and it just has to be just so, but need to sound effortless. And for me, it's also a joy to do, because when Mozart piano concertos are, I always think of them as basically as vocal writing, most of it. And here you really can, one of the few times that you can really combine the two and see how close they are and how much give and take there is and how much you can shape your the way that you play according to what you hear the singer doing, not just imagining the singer.
Well, it is very often observed that Mozart's piano concertos are operatic in nature. They're extremely narrative, and of course the pianist is the protagonist of whatever opera is going on. And so what are the roles in this concert aria? Now we're going to return to a little music theory.
This is yours.
I was really bad at theory at school.
You'll like this though. There's an actual form in Italian opera called the scena, and a scena has very particular characteristics and sequence of ideas. And Mozart is writing a little before, because one thinks of the scena as being bel canto, and then Verdi always writes in scena form, and then after Verdi it sort of declines. Puccini is not any longer in the scena form. But in a scena, there's got to be a problem, and so the first thing is the singer is going to tell you something about the problem, often in a more recitativo style, parlando style. The problem here is the singer starts saying what
You asked me to forget you.
You asked me to forget you.
You think I could? And then she goes on to say, how can you expect me to live? To live without you would be unconscionable. I would write, to actually, the best, that's the best line, actually. She says, to live without you would be worse than death. Mm. Come death.
Right.
I would rather die right now.
So that's the problem.
It's a little dramatic.
Right, no, that's, no, so she has a big problem. That's why she's in opera.
Not me, personally.
Then,
facts.
Okay, then a normal scena continues with the tempo di adagio, or the cavatino, which is a slow thing where the character is thinking about the problem or about what can happen. And very often, at this moment, at the end of the cavatino, you have the tempo di mezzo, and another character comes in. And there's a new viewpoint on the problem because the other character comes in and says, wait a minute, your father just died, or something.
Perspective change.
Yeah, and there's a perspective change, and then there's the cavaletta, or the fast part that ends it. So
basically the resolution and the decision of what to do.
So Chi mi scordi di te has all of these elements in all the right order, but the character who comes in is the pianist.
And he has a lot to say.
I'm sorry, I've got, it's all from a script, it's not me.
You're just doing what he said to do.
Yes, exactly. I'm just following my orders. Yeah.
Well, it's a very brilliant piece, and it is a piece that Schwarzkopf made. Leontine Price had huge success with it. Joan Sutherland. So it's a real star vehicle.
It's a thing. It's a something.
It's really something. Yeah. So I just do want all of you here today and all of you listening on the radio, do come at 6 p.m. Friday to hear Inon Bandertan and Golda Schultz. Now we're going to switch gears a little bit. Because Aspen has at its core mission education of musicians, I wanted to talk a little about how both of you, you know, came into your careers and traditions of teaching. And I'll start with Inon, because he mentioned Maria Curcio, who was his teacher in London. In Israel, when you started out as a musician, you were being taught in a great Russian tradition of Neuhaus. And then you went to London, and there was the Schnabel tradition and Maria Curcio. And then later, you have given a lot of credit with the importance of the ideas of Leon Fleischer in your work. So would you talk about these traditions, how different they are, how you as an artist take from different ones?
Yeah, I mean, I've been very, very lucky in that respect, because also the Neuhaus tradition, he taught some of the great Russian pianists like Gilels and Richter, but he also, first of all, those are people that we think of not necessarily just as, you know, people that play Rachmaninoff concertos, but they're, you know, also the key interpreters of German music. I mean, you think of Gilels and Richter, and also you taught Lupu, and you think of them also as Beethoven, Schubert, all those. So, I mean, it's not, you can't really kind of compartmentalize, it as being kind of completely but different things. But it's such a rich tradition, and I mean Schnabel through both Maria Curcio and Leon Fleischer were Schnabel students, and he apparently had the most profound effect on any of his students because they basically just worshipped him. And there's a line that goes directly from Schnabel to Beethoven. Schnabel studied with Leschetizky, I think, who started with Liszt, who started with Czerny, who started with Beethoven. And I know how much when I do a masterclass, how much of what I'm saying is things that I learned from my teachers. So one can only wonder how much of that has filtered through, you know, how much is of that tradition as filtered through the generations. And it's very humbling to think about how close we are to these kind of flesh and blood people. But for me, all three kind of major teachers in my life, I've learned so much. There's not a day that goes by, not a piece that I play without thinking of some sort of advice that I got from them. So, I mean, for me, the mission of this festival is so important and so, just so central. I mean, I just came here this past weekend. I played at Ravinia with the Chicago Symphony, and Ravinia also has an institute where I never came to Aspen as the school, but I did go to Ravinia to the Staines Institute for 3 summers. And to this day, so many of the people that I know, I met Fleischer there, so many of my colleagues, and so much of the advice that I carry in my head comes from them. So it's so invaluable, even just being exposed to all these things, let alone getting direct teaching, I feel very, very lucky.
Leon Fleischer had a thing, I just love repeating it every chance I get. It was a standard masterclass advice he would give, but he would stop the student and say, I wish you would play this more rhythmically. Then the student would think, I'm playing the rhythms, but would play again. He'd say, no, more rhythmically, and then he would finally say, you know what playing rhythmically means? It means playing everything as late as possible without ever being late.
Yeah, he had a lot of these. Unbelievable pieces of advice that you carry with you. For him, the music is kind of like the surface of an ocean with, you know, an iceberg with icebergs, and the shape of the iceberg that you can see is entirely dependent on the shape that you can see under the water. Yeah. So where you place notes depends on this kind of unseen and unheard grid, so that when you place it right, it makes sense. Yeah. So the rhythmically, like when you put things where they should be, suddenly things fall together, and it's remarkable. I mean, I could spend hours talking about it, but Maria Corcho also had attacked him from a different perspective, my Russian teacher from a different perspective, but all these things combined are so interesting. He had this one of the pieces of advice that Fleischer always said about the difference between romantic and classical music, and that in classical music you tend to hold on to long notes and go over the small notes, and in romantic music is the opposite. You are impatient with the long notes and you stretch out the small notes. And when you actually start applying that, it makes so much sense. Just these like very simple principles that just help you. It's not about, you know, play this way, play that way, but how do you treat material? How do you, how when you get something that you haven't played before, how do you, if your teacher is not there to say, do this, do that, how do you treat it? How do you deal with it? And that's invaluable.
So, Goldo, turning to your own educational experience, the kind of lyric soprano that you are, so Renee Fleming entered her career in Mozart roles on her way to Strauss roles, and, Leontine Price in Mozart roles on her way to Verdi roles, and Schwarzkopf, you know, a different trajectory. So there's so many examples, but how do you form your own identity within your voice?
I think the biggest thing is, the biggest educator is trial and error. Yeah, it's an honest educator. You know, everyone has dreams of where they'd like their voice to go, but unlike an instrumentalist, the instrument changes because I am the instrument. So, and for women, it's even more interesting in that sense. So as you go along, you keep trying things out. And the nice thing about Mozart is that I feel like for singers, Mozart is the ultimate educator. It's exactly what you said. There's exposure. There is nothing to hide behind. Even with this piece that we're doing, you know, the I always thought to myself, whenever I'd like listen to it, I've always thought, oh, the orchestra, like, they sound like they're really like giving some kick. And today I was like, oh no, it's just me and the it's just me and Enon. They're just oompa-pying in the background. And knowing that that's happening, you realize how exposed you are, and then you have to really focus in. So that's why Mozart's such a great educator. And when you're able to really hone that, it opens up so many other avenues for you, because Mozart really does have everything. There's long legato lines, there's wonderful coloratura if you also want that. And if you can learn to do that well, and you learn to do it with your voice, no matter what your voice is doing and where your voice is going, it will show you the door that you need to go through next. So I always find it very worrisome when people say things like, oh yeah, I'm doing Mozart and then I'm going to do this and this and this. I just go, I'm doing Mozart. Just going to stick around here until someone else tells me I should be somewhere else. But I mean, it would be lovely to be able to say that I can go into bigger repertoire, but the content that he gave us is so vast. I mean, the concert arias alone, there are 54, you know? That's a lot of singing, a lot of notes. So even those, every concert aria is a this microcosm of possibilities and things to learn. Each one is different. Each one has other aspects of virtuosity that are required of you. And if you can really focus yourself to be able to do each one, every other composer starts to make sense, because you see how people borrow from what they've heard. You can see how Beethoven borrowed from Mozart, was inspired by Mozart. You see how Rachmaninoff was inspired by Beethoven. You hear all these things and you start to go, oh, well, if he's doing it like this, then maybe I could use the approach that I used previously to find a way in and sing it with my voice. And the trick is, as a singer, you never change your voice to suit the music. You make the music suit your voice. That's the actual talent of the instrument. It should never feel like you're overwhelmed by what's going on. It should always feel that it is fitting to what you are capable of doing, because that is why composers write vocal music. It is to allow the voice to do something special. It's not necessary. It should never be to be difficult. So I feel that's why Mozart's such a great educator. And I think that's why a lot of people, a lot of really good singers and all the singers I admire and respect, all go through Mozart, go through the school of Mozart. So if there was any sort of like education for singers or any school of education, I think there's the Mozartian way and then everybody else.
Well, so Maria Callas famously had a mentor who was not a voice teacher, but a conductor, Tullio Serafin. Do you have someone who is helping you choose what you sing, how you sing, how much you sing?
I have a board. I like to call them my board of directors. That's not necessarily one person in particular. There are voices and ears that I trust. So for a singer, it's really important to have people who listen to you authentically and give you honest feedback. So if you can find those people, they're the ones who can really help you to decide whether or not there's a role that you should or shouldn't do, or a concert that you should or shouldn't do. But the buck ends with me, you know, saying yes or saying no. This is all my choice. So the first question that I always have to ask myself before I even talk to anybody else is, do I even want to try? And if I don't want to try, then there's no point bringing anyone else into the conversation, because it defeats the purpose. I don't want to have people convincing me to do something that I don't want to do. If I have to convince other people that I should do something, that's a different story. And I like that challenge of trying to show people, oh, but I could do this with my voice as it is. It doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, horrifyingly dramatic. Something like Vitalia, it's a vastly huge role, in the sense that it goes all the way down there and goes all the way up there. And if you have some conductors who want you to ornament like crazy, it's very difficult to kind of balance that. But why I did it is because I wanted to do it with my voice, and I felt I had something to say. And if I have that behind me, then everything else becomes secondary. But there are people who I definitely trust. And if they agree with me that something's worth doing, then I go full hilt toward the windmills.
We had Don Quixote last week, too. So see. Okay, so have you ever turned down a really important opportunity because you thought it wasn't going to be right for you?
Yes.
Do you want to say what the role was? No, not where, just...
I actually ended up doing it. Don't worry. So this is it's a happy story. it was Mozart. And Franz Welser Moerst, I had done Sophie at the Salzburg Festspiel with him, and he had decided that he wanted me to do Susanna at Scala. And I said, oh, but I don't want to sing Susanna. It's too difficult. It's too long, too many notes. And it really took, I think it took us about like 2 weeks for me to be convinced. And this was the only time that I've ever had to, that I've had to be convinced of doing something. And it really, my arguments were not vocal at all. They were just personal. And sometimes those arguments work, but sometimes they don't. And with someone like a conductor like Franz, he will never take a personal argument. He'll be like, tell me the musical reasons why this is impossible for you to do. The scheduling reasons why this is impossible for you to do. Because if it is that you just don't feel like it, it will be fun because we will do this together and we will find a way to make this a good experience. And I really was so thrilled that I did it because it really was a great experience to work with him on such a, you know, Susanna is the... In terms of the operatic canon, her and I would have to say, something like singing something like Wagner, like Brunhilde, like Susanna and Brunhilde are probably the biggest roles sopranos will sing for a lyric and a soubrette soprano Susanna, because there's so many notes and there are so many vastly different aspects of your personality and your vocalization that need to come out. And having to work on that with him was really exciting in the end. But it doesn't mean I'm going to repeat it. And there have been people who've asked me to do it again, and I was like, nope, that was a once-off, and I'm glad I did it. But I won't be repeating it, because that I did because of the experience of working with him on that, and that's what made it so special. The experience of doing Susanna herself, it has never really thrilled me. I kind of feel like... As a woman, I always just feel very, very sorry for her that she has to deal with so much on the day that she's getting married. And when I was doing the role myself, I was just like, this is exhausting. This is the most exhausting experience of my life. So I don't want to run a marathon again.
So you think the Countess is much easier to manage?
It really is. And, you know, you realize that Mozart really did write it for Nancy. He wrote this role for her. And there are varying descriptions of her voice. Some people have said that it was one of the best soubrette voices you've ever heard. Then there are others who describe her voice as being a little bit rough and not necessarily well connected. But she was a tremendous actress. And then when you try to balance all that, you kind of see how he really wrote it to show the best parts of her voice and her personality. And everyone who sings Susanna is just trying to live up to the memory of Nancy. So it's very, and you know, that's a, and why, so why this aria is also so special, because not only did he write it for himself and for her to do together, it really is a duet. It's not necessarily an aria, because what you see is that there are a lot of conversational lines between the piano and the voice. Sometimes the voice accompanies the piano in whatever it's doing, and it's virtuosic what the piano is doing. And then there are some times when there's some crazy stuff happening in the voice, and the piano literally answers and replies with a new idea or something else. And so that's really exciting, because you sense that friendship. And that's what that was about. There's a lot of affection in the piece itself, and that's really special to try and to bring that kind of memory to life. It's exactly what you were saying about, you know, being so close to the lineage of Beethoven from people who've taught him, and you feel the flesh and blood connection. Being on stage with a piece like this that was written for a friend, from a friend, to say goodbye and to say to that person, I will never forget you, that's what this is. He wrote her a piece that has made her relevant past her lifetime. He has never forgotten her, and we will never forget her. He gave her the greatest gift, and that's what makes this so special.
Well, what a beautiful statement. Lulu is a killer role in, you know, in all respects.
Quite a killer.
Yeah, literally and figuratively. We have just a few minutes, and I thought we would go to questions from the audience for Enon and Golda, and do wait for the microphone to come to you.
Yes. Do you have thoughts about people who failed as concert artists and yet were superb teachers?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, it's not only that, the opposite is also true. Meaning there are a lot of people that are superb performers that are not particularly insightful as teachers. It doesn't necessarily go together. There's some performers that are very instinctive, and what they do is not cerebral, or they don't necessarily know how to translate what works for them for other people. I think one of the reasons Fleischer was such a great teacher, apart from everything else, is that he was forced to examine, because he had his problem with he couldn't play with his right hand. And he was forced to actually, he couldn't demonstrate always, or he couldn't, you know, to actually convert his thoughts into words. How do you actually deal with this? And I remember once when I was much younger, asking, I was in the room with Marta Argerich and saying, you know, I'd love to play for you. And she said, well, I'm not very insightful, she said to me. And I mean, and obviously it's not true, but on the other hand, I understand what she said. Like she meant that for her, what she does is it works for her, but she doesn't necessarily know how to translate that. So yeah, I don't think there's necessarily a connection between one or the other.
Yeah, I think the trait of a good teacher is being able to speak the language of the student and not try to enforce your own way of thinking and your own process onto them. Yes, you want them to learn from point A to point B, you need to do the following, but it's the way that each person needs that to be described to them is completely different. I had my favorite singing teacher, and she's still the person that I consult regularly. She has different imagery she uses for every single student, and we're all learning the exact same thing: how to prepare a phrase, how to, you know, bring your diaphragm down, release your floor, your pelvic floor, all of these things. But some people don't understand that. So for some people, she'll say, plant your feet in the ground like a tree. And that instinctively means the exact same thing that it would to someone else that she like literally will explain it word for word. But I feel probably why I think that a lot of, I hate using the word failed concert artists, failed soloists as teachers, is that people, like I said previously, failure is the best teacher. And losing something, losing the ability to do something, you have to learn what was it that got you to the point where you lost it? How do you rectify? And because you have to go through the process of failure and reckon with yourself and how you got there and how you get back up, those are the things that make people good teachers, not necessarily having success all the time. Success doesn't really teach much, I don't think.
Yeah. In some ways, the advantage of being, and it's not the success, it's just the actual, for the teacher to be a performer, is that sometimes you can learn a lot from watching or hearing somebody do something. And it inspires you, and you can take it in. So that there's a lot to be learned from hearing somebody play something. So it always helps if you can demonstrate and see it helps. But it's not a prerequisite. It's much as Golda said. It's much more important to figure out what needs to be enforced in the student's playing, not how they should play something, but what's missing, what can you kind of boost in their overall performance that would make it more successful, not in the kind of it's not from outside but from the inside, and that's performing doesn't always teach you that. That's a different experience.
I would just throw in a different element, which is that Golda and Enon, who are having major international careers, in addition to having to have the talent and hard work and achievement to do that, they undergo a really difficult lifestyle of travel. And not everybody can do that. And so I have seen people of immense ability decide not to because it's just so hard. So we have to thank them for persevering.
You know, it's also one of the things that we're told from so early on that what success is for you to be a big soloist with orchestras and singing all the, but sometimes the success is for you to be happy and to do what you want to do. I mean, for somebody to be in an orchestra or to be a teacher or to be whatever it is, but to deal with music in a way that, I mean, our lifestyle is, as you say, is not for everybody. And a lot of people would be miserable. And chasing this kind of idea of success or choosing not to does not mean you've failed.
Yeah.
Well, our time has come to an end, but I want to say thank you to Enon Barnaton and Golda Schultz, who will be with us Friday night.